Mine an asteroid?
Doug rolled right along, hardly drawing a breath. We can convert one of the transfer ships to make a rendezvous with a carbon-bearing asteroid. There's plenty of them in orbits that come close to the Earth-Moon system. No need to go out to the asteroid belt. That's way out past Mars.
Do you really think you can build clipper ships out of diamond? Joanna asked.
When her question reached him, Doug replied easily,
Why not?
It's just a matter of programming nanomachines.
And a diamond ship will be better than the ones we're manufacturing now?
Doug waited patiently, then answered,
They'll be lighter, much stronger, capable of carrying heavier payloads with the same rocket thrust, safer, more durable. What else can you ask for?
Cheaper to manufacture, Joanna replied. He nodded once he heard her response.
Not only cheaper to manufacture, but the aerospace lines will be willing to pay more for them since they'll perform so much better than today's ships.
Despite herself, Joanna felt almost breathless at the sweep of Doug's vision.
We could use nanomachines to manufacture other things, too, couldn't we?
Aircraft, Doug said.
Automobiles.
Houses, Doug added, grinning hugely.
All by using nanomachines for manufacturing, said Joanna.
Masterson Corporation could become the biggest, most powerful company in the solar system.
Joanna felt the same excitement her son did. But then she remembered the realities.
People are afraid of nanotechnology, Doug. There are powerful forces opposing it.
His cheerful grin didn't shrink by a millimeter when he heard her doubts.
But don't you see, Mom? This will show everybody that nanotechnology works. It'll knock the opposition flat.
And it will save Moonbase, Joanna said.
Right!
If it works, Joanna thought. If the nano-Luddites don't prevent us from doing it. If Greg doesn't try to stop his brother from trying.
Ballistic Vehicle 1.
The liftoff wasn't exactly silent. When the rocket ignited, Doug could feel a surge of vibration in his bones that rumbled in his ears almost like sound. Still, the lack of thundering noise made Doug feel slightly eerie, and of course the thrust he felt was minuscule compared to a clipper ship liftoff from Earth. The excitement of the previous night's conversation with his mother hadn't worn off exactly. The thought of going out to capture an asteroid and then using its carbon to build clipper ships out of diamond still tingled in the back of Doug's mind. But that was for the future. This flight to the moon's south pole was now. He had spent an hour in the main airlock, big enough to accommodate full-size tractors and dozens of people, pre-breathing the oxygen-nitrogen mixture that they would be using throughout the expedition. Moonbase ran on normal air, almost 80% nitrogen and 20% oxygen, with traces of carbon dioxide and water vapor, all at 14.7 pounds per square inch, almost exactly like the clean, dry atmosphere of a desert region on Earth. The surface units still worked at 5 psi, with a 72-28 ratio of oxygen to nitrogen. Moonbase safety regulations called for pre-breathing the spacesuit mix for an hour before going outside, to get the excess nitrogen out of the bloodstream and prevent the bends. Now, strapped into the bare metal seat in the ballistic lobber, his suit buttoned up tight, Doug felt weird as the rocket engines blasted them off the floor of Alphonsus in almost total silence. The lobbers were modified versions of the transfer spacecraft that shuttled passengers and freight from Earth orbit to the moon. There was nothing aerodynamic about them since they never flew in an atmosphere. They were utilitarian assemblies of silvered tankage, rocket engines, bulky cargo containers, pressurized personnel pods, and spindly legs that jutted out from the four corners of the spacecraft's main platform. The spacecraft rose quickly enough. Doug could see through the transparent bubble of the passenger pod the slumped mountains of the ring wall whiz past, and then nothing but the darkness of space. But there was hardly any palpable acceleration. None of the heavy forces that pushed you down in your seat when you lifted off from Earth. Then all sense of thrust disappeared. The vibration ceased, too. Engines have cut off, Doug knew. We're coasting on a ballistic trajectory now, like an artillery shell. His suit helmet cut off his view of Bianca Ree sitting beside him. There were four others crowded into the plastiglass bubble of a passenger module, plus Brennard and Killifer up in the cockpit module. The eight other expedition members were in the second lobber. The other two rocket vehicles carried only cargo. Unmanned, they were guided remotely.
How do you like it?
He asked Bianca. Her voice in his helmet earphones sounded strained.
If I could walk, I'd do it.
Doug laughed.
This is a lot easier than walking, and safer.
It's the free fall, said Bianca. Makes my stomach want to turn inside out.
Well, try to relax. We'll be back on the ground in about half an hour.
Can't be too soon. The spacecraft tilted forward a few degrees, enough so that they could look down at the cratered mountain sliding below them, dwindling as the lobber headed for the peak of its ballistic trajectory. Bianca groaned aloud.
Isn't that Tycho?
Doug said, tapping a gloved finger against the plastiglass canopy.
Over there, near the horizon.
The crater was unmistakable. Big and sharp, with bright rays of debris streaking out of it for hundreds of miles. One of the newest big craters on the moon, Doug said to himself. Not even a billion years old.
Tycho,
Bianca said, awed.
Wow, I've never seen it so close.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Said Doug.
Sure is.
She leaned over until her helmet visor was touching the canopy's plastiglass. Doug knew that Tycho marked the midpoint of their half-hour flight. He hoped it would keep Bianca fascinated long enough to make her forget about barfing. Foster Brennart sat up in the lobber's cockpit, a separate and smaller bubble that projected out to one side. Jack Killifer was in the co-pilot seat. Panels of instruments and controls surrounded them at waist height. Above the panel, the bubble was clear plastiglass. Killifer took a wire from one of the pouches in his spacesuit's belt, plugged it into an access port in the side of his helmet, then plugged the other end into the similar port in Brennart's helmet. Now they could talk to one another without using their suit radios, which might be overheard.
Smooth liftoff, Killifer said.
If Brennart was flattered by the praise, his tone failed to show it.
Check the other craft. See how their takeoffs went.
Right.
Killifer dutifully called the second ballistic craft as he checked the instrument readouts for the two unmanned vehicles.
No problems. Just like four tennis balls, Killifer said to the expedition commander.
Tennis balls?
Brennart sounded puzzled.
That's where the term lobber comes from, Foster. These ballistic birds go like a tennis ball that's been lobbed up in the air.
He gestured with his gloved hand.
Up, 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 and then down, down, down.
Brennart was silent for a few moments.
Never played tennis, he said at last. Never had the time.
I used to, a little, said Killifer, back when I was in California.
The memory ached in his gut. Nanotechnology had not expanded much in the 18 years since he'd been forced out of the field.
Still, he told himself, I could have been an executive, a rich man, a leader in the field. I could have taken Cardenas' spot when she left the corporation. Instead, here I am, a 250,000 miles from anything worthwhile, second in command on a loony expedition to the ass end of nowhere, with Joanna Stavanger's son stuck into the pecking order ahead of me.
Deftly, Brennart fired the attitude control jets, just a slight puff to tilt the craft enough so they could see the ground sliding by far below them. Rugged mountains, peppered with craters.
No one's ever set foot on that territory, Brennart said.
Not yet,
Killifer grunted. He was still thinking about his younger days in California.
We've only begun to explore the moon. There's a whole world waiting for us to put our boot prints on it, said Brennart.
Killifer smiled inside his helmet.
Wasn't this expedition your idea?
It certainly was, Brennart answered immediately. It took the better part of 2 years to convince Mrs. Stavanger to let us go. It wasn't until I showed her that Yamagata's preparing an expedition that she finally gave her okay.
That's what I thought.
Brennart turned toward him. In the spacesuit, it required him to move from the waist, torso, and shoulders so he could look at his second in command. What he saw was the reflection of his own helmet in Killifer's visor.
You know how hard I worked to convince her. Of course this expedition is my idea. Who else's?
Nobody, Killifer replied. Only...
Only what?
Why'd she send her kid along?
Douglas?
Yeah.
He's like a kid with a new toy, all excited about being on the moon and working with me, Brennart said happily.
Oh, said Killifer. Yeah.
It only took a couple of seconds for